This is a collection of recordings I made with some of the world's most knowledgeable, well-known, and successful whitetail hunters on the planet. I know you're really going to enjoy and learn from the wisdom they share, along with their personal life and their walk with God. I hope you enjoy these classic conversations. I've got Dr. David Samuel. Buddy, it is good to have you with us today. Where are you calling from today?
I'm in Morgantown, West Virginia, and it's good to be here.
You got one leg longer than the other one?
Everybody in West Virginia has.
I grew up in Pennsylvania, and so every time I drive down the, was it the Blue Ridge Parkway?
No, that's Virginia.
No, wait, what am I thinking? What's the one that comes right up through?
Well, it's 70, whatever, 70.
79 or?
79, because yeah. Right down through Morgantown, actually.
Yeah, boy, Pittsburgh. It's, yeah. You got some steep little hills down there.
We do, but they're full of deer, Brent.
Yeah, well, that's what we're going to talk about. Dave, you have been, when I look at all the biographies of everybody I've got on here, and I couldn't fit it all, like even in my notebook. You've been 30 years as a professor of wildlife management at WVU. You've got your doctorate in wildlife biology. You've been the conservation editor of Bow Hunting Magazine for almost, what, 40 years?
Well, we're going to be 40 years next October.
Wow. This holy cow.
Yeah, not this October, in 2011.
And your column called No Hunting, now that still appears, doesn't it?
It's been in there for 25 or 30 years, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, oh, yeah, I still do it.
Now, I know you're, obviously we know you're a writer. You've put out a number of books and articles. I mean, just tons. You're a professional speaker. I know one time, a couple of years ago, you weren't able to do an event. We'll get to that a little bit later, and I filled in for you, and it was some awfully big shoes to fill. But you've been a researcher. You've been, bow hunting for, it's got to be close to 60 years.
You know, I was in the hospital most of 2008, so I missed that year. And so this will be my 59th year, I think.
Yeah. Okay. And in 2007, I was at the ATA show in Indianapolis, and that night you received an honor that was pretty amazing, and that was you were inducted into the Archery Hall of Fame. That same night, right alongside, I believe it was Chuck Adams.
Actually, Chuck was the year after me.
Was it? Well, I was there the night you were inducted, so I'm just trying I kind of lose track of time.
Yeah, but anyway, what an honor that was, Brent. I mean, all of my childhood heroes. I mean, Fred Bear, Ishii, you name it. And there's about 60 people in that Hall of Fame. And to go in there with all the top icons of archery, it was really special.
Well, you received, let me see, was it down last year you received two Lifetime Achievement Awards?
I did last year, yeah.
And those were what? Those were for whitetail deer management?
You know, we're recording this and I'm sitting at my desk and I'm looking right at the plaques right in front of me. They're right by my computer. The first was from the Wildlife Society at that Southeast Deer Study Group meeting, and it was the Deer Management Career Achievement Award, and they don't give that every year, and that was really special, because that's given to you by the top deer people in the United States.
Yeah, that's a big one.
300 or 400 of the top deer biologists and managers. And then at the Quality Deer Management Association meeting in 2009, I got the Joe Hamilton Lifetime Achievement Award. And they've given 7 of those or so. And to get both, those are the top 2 deer awards you can get. And to get them both in the same year, to get them both in any year, is quite an honor.
Well, and I think for the guys that are going to listen, you know, to this, you guys, you can hear what's coming. This, you know, Dr. Dave knows big time what he's talking about. I watch your segments, No Hunting, you know, on bowhunting.net and BowTube regularly. I've had opportunities to sit with you on a few occasions, you know, at some of the outdoor shows and just catch up. I mean, I'm still looking at your bio here. In the 1980s, let's see, you were the president of the National Bowhunter Education Foundation for 2 terms. You've been the vice president of the American Archery Council for 7 terms. I mean, there's just advisory boards, board of directors. Do you ever slow down?
Well, I have since this bad surgery I had in 2007 that hurt.
Tell us a little bit. You know, those that can't really see what's going on, Dave, you know, this guy doesn't slow down, but in the last couple of years, things have changed a little bit. Tell us a little bit about what happened.
They've changed a lot. I mean, it changed my whole life. I had a rapid heartbeat, irregular heartbeat in the fall of 2007, and it had gotten worse. And so they decided to do this procedure where they go into your chest and laser some nervous pathways on the surface of your heart. But the surgeon made a mistake and he cut the nerve to my diaphragm. Mm. And that's not fixable. That's permanent. When that happens, nobody's ever recovered from that. In history, and I don't think God means for me to be the first. And so I've lost my right lung, which is about 60% of your breathing. But and then in addition to that, the paralyzed diaphragm did something that nobody had ever seen before. It was crushing my right atrium. And a wonderful bow hunter named Warren Strickland, who's a heck of a cardiologist from Huntsville, Alabama, found that problem for me, and then I went to Cleveland Clinic and had a really serious surgery where they tighten up your diaphragm. Mine was paralyzed, but they pleat it and sew it together to pull it off of my heart. And it's a very tough surgery, and from that, you always have pain. And they warned me about it, but I had no choice because I was going to die if we didn't do it. And the surgeon was wonderful, and he did the surgery successfully. And he didn't lie to me when he said you're going to have really bad pain the rest of your life, and it's tough. But it is what it is. You can't go back. I mean, you just have to. And I'm not always this optimistic. I mean, there are days when I wake up and the pain's there all the time, and it just really wrecks you. But most of the time, with God's help, you know, I'm able to be positive. The surgeon did not cut the nerve to my brain, and so I'm able to sit here at a computer and work.
Boy, we are glad.
And so I've written 3 books since that surgery, and 2 of which are out there on deer, and the third one's not published yet. And I'm able now to get back into my churches and do game dinners. I did about 13 of them last spring, and they are wonderful doing those game dinners. I really missed those in 2008, and you covered for me at several of mine, and I really appreciated that. You know, I'm still doing things that I can do, and I'm even able to bow hunt a little bit.
Now, you just told me, you just got back from a trip. We were going to do this interview a few weeks ago, and I had a little family emergency of my own, but you didn't slow down enough to keep you out of the woods. Tell us a little bit about where you just went and what happened.
Yeah. Well, I can't fly in an airplane. I tried, and I passed out, and I'm not sure what that's all about, but I guess I don't have enough oxygen to be in a plane. So my doctors don't let me get on planes. So I went on Amtrak and I hunted in eastern Colorado two or three weeks ago with Fred and Michelle Eichler and killed a really nice antelope. I can sit in a blind, so that's what I do. I mean, it's not my favorite way to hunt, but...
Well, we are glad to have you here, and we are so glad that you, you're still able to get back on your feet and get out and do some of these things that you love, and we are looking forward to some of the knowledge, you know, no hunting that you're going to bring to us. Let's go ahead. I want to get things started, and one of the questions before we get things rolling is, on your website, thenohunting.com, there's a place for Q&A on there, and someone had asked a question, and they said, is the anti-hunting phenomenon really a problem for wildlife? And if so, you know, why?
Well, that's a lot to answer, but the simple truth is, you bet. Anti-hunting, anything that stops or reduces the amount of hunting we do is really bad for wildlife. And one of the main reasons is hunters pay the bills. They There's an excise tax, a federal excise tax, and every time they buy hunting equipment, they pay 11% excise tax. And all of that money, literally all of it, goes straight to the state wildlife agencies to manage wildlife. And it not only manages the game animals, it manages the non-game animals, the endangered species. It pays for law enforcement. It pays for hunter education. Without it, the state wildlife agencies would go bankrupt. And so it's a big deal just from that end alone.
What are the numbers like in the last, maybe even in the last decade, from how many hunting licenses were being purchased as to now?
At one point, we were about 16 million, and we're down now below 12 million hunters and hunting licenses. And the even scarier is the average age of the hunters that are actively hunting is getting older faster than the general population. So we're literally a dying breed, and we're not creating enough young hunters to replace the old ones that we're losing.
Well, that kind of goes into my first question, and one of the things is talking about the young hunter. You know, we're losing so many of these kids, you know, to technology, you know, televisions and PlayStations and Xboxes, and even after school, you know, extracurricular activities. There's so much going on. Yep. That there wasn't, you know, 40, 50 years ago.
Yep.
What is something that you could pass on to these young hunters? Because I know a big piece of getting these kids to stay out there and to get them in the woods is, you know, they want to be successful. And deer populations have changed because of the way that society has expanded. It's put them in different areas, and we have to kind of look at things a little bit different. What is something you could pass on to that novice hunter that's going to really, you know, help keep him excited and again help him be successful, not just maybe in the harvest, but even, you know, seeing game, and so that he's going to want to go back out there again?
Well, you know, there's a couple things there. First off, the states have to change their laws so that the kids can hunt before they're 12 years of age, and a lot of states have already done that, because by the time they're 12, they're already playing soccer and doing computers and all that other stuff. So we got to get them earlier, and that can be done safely, and it is being done. So that's a positive thing. You know, one other thing too, the parents have to get the kids in the woods, and they don't need to drag them out there and make them sit in a tree stand and be quiet and hunt and do serious stuff. Go shed hunting or whatever. Just take them for walks in the woods. Anything that'll get them out there, but make it fun. You know, don't make it that you got to kill a deer to be successful. You don't. Just get them out when they're very young, and let them have fun. Kids love the woods, you know. So now relative to those young kids getting out there. And what do they do? That's a little tougher. But what I'm finding is that it's harder and harder for young kids to have a mentor that'll take them out. A lot of kids live in cities where their parents don't hunt. And I'll tell you, Brent, I have gotten involved with the Boy Scouts and the Cub Scouts here lately. I'm on the local board of the Boy Scouts, and they have tremendous outdoor programs. And so one piece of advice I would give to any child and any parent is get your son involved in the scouting. And that is a really great way to get them into the outdoors.
My son loved it when we were living in Pennsylvania when he was
sure
a little younger.
Did.
We got him in, and he just loved it.
They love it. And then one of the first things, if they get into bow hunting when they're young, is get them into a bow hunter education course, which are available everywhere.
And they can just get that online as well?
Yeah, they can just go to, you know, when you just Google bow hunter education class, and it'll come up. And then you can track down local people and take a class. That is a great way to learn. You know, I was involved with that for 24 years, and that's a great way to get kids out there doing. Yeah, you know, one other thing. You know, we get this National Archery in the School program, which is tremendous. And so if there's just one thing that can turn kids on to hunting is shooting a bow. I don't mean going out and killing a deer with a bow. I just mean going and shooting an archery target. I mean, most of us who bow hunt, and I'll bet you did too. Man, we loved it when we were kids, just shooting a bow. I mean, it was a big deal, and it was fun. And nothing whets your appetite more about bow hunting than just plain archery in the backyard.
I saw Fred Bear at a seminar when I was a kid. My dad took me.
Wow.
And I watched him kill that big brown bear up there in Wide Bay. That old Kodiak. And it was like it was like, I don't know, 15 feet or some crazy, really close to him.
Yeah.
And I came home, got my first little fiberglass recurve bow, and went out and got a cardboard box and drew the face of a bear on there with blood dripping off of the fangs. And I wanted to be Fred Bear.
Hey, me too.
Yeah.
Me too. Ever since I saw that footage when I was a kid or younger, I wasn't a kid, but I was definitely a lot younger. I've dreamed of killing a big brown bear with my bow. Now, I'm not going to get to do it now because I can't get there because there's no way to get there. But, those kinds of things are fun for kids.
Now, you've got a lot of events that you go and you speak to, whether it's, I'm sure in outdoor stores or whether it be for churches or different wild game banquet type things. And you get, you get some novice hunters coming in, like I was as a kid, looking up to Fred Bear. And you get people looking up to you with all of your knowledge and experience. But you get these guys coming to the events, too, that are your experienced hunters. They've been doing this for a while. And I learn a lot from them as well. I always want to listen because I know that listening probably is the beginning of wisdom. And you get these guys coming in, and they want to know something maybe that's going to help them be even more successful. What's some of the things that you see that you could pass on to these guys, maybe mistakes they're making or tips or secrets that you do that really has helped your success?
Well, let me just back up a second, because you're exactly right. I get a lot of experienced bow hunters or gun hunters in general who come to my talks at these churches especially. And I spent 30 years teaching about deer and deer biology and researching all the latest literature and then regurgitating it in my No Hunting column and in other writings that I did for other magazines, regurgitating that information for deer hunters. And that's what I do at these seminars. I take all the latest science and I cook it down into a message that anybody can figure out and understand. And that's been my, if you will, that's Dr. Dave. That's what Dr. Dave's always been. He's the guy who knows the science and then tells the hunters about stuff that they didn't really know about. For example, when I grew up, my dad taught me that an adult buck, would mate 8 to 10 does every fall. Well, we now know from DNA studies that that's not true. The average buck only mates 1 or 2 does a year.
Oh, wow.
He doesn't mate. He doesn't go running around mating a ton of them. And when you think about it, it really wouldn't even be possible, because when a buck finds a hot doe, he stays with her for 3 days or so and then finally mates her. And, those does aren't in heat all that long in the rut. The rut isn't very long. It's only 2 weeks long. So he really couldn't be mating a ton of does. Even if he had them lined up, he couldn't do it. So, they don't mate me. So I just dig out all that kind of information, and a lot of it's mythical, and some of it's fun.
Let me ask you a question, because this is, you're talking about, you maybe only 2 deer he's breeding with in that 2 week period.
Yep.
We know Charlie Alshimer is really big on when the rut's going to be coming in, talking about moon phases and a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have, I know Bill Winkie's going to be talking about stand placement and corridors and different things. But with your experience, that's the magical time. I mean, the rut is the time when we all just can't wait for it to get here. From your experience, and maybe this is almost like question number 3 almost in a way, which is when you look at all the knowledge you've gained, and it doesn't have to be just the last 10 years, but when you look at that, these guys coming in, experienced, novice, whatever, that's the magical time. What have you learned about that magical time that has maybe revolutionized or really helped you adapt to understand these deer more, to know where to hunt? How do you do this?
Well, a couple things. One thing I learned the hard way, and that is, do not overhunt a stand. Only go to a stand when you've got the right wind. You watch some of these experts on TV, like Bill Winkie, or Lee Lukowski and Tiffany Lukowski, who are good friends of mine too, and you listen to them, and they're gonna point out, well, I've been this stand is only good in a west wind, and I've been waiting for it for 3 weeks, and today was a west wind. So those guys know something. And it took me a while to figure this out. You know, I thought, okay, I can sneak in there and be quiet, and the wind's going to be okay. And, well, if it's not the right wind for that stand, then you've got to stay the heck out of there. Now, I don't care if it's the best stand you've hunted. If you killed a Boone and Crockett the year before there, you just don't want to overhunt that stand, and you only want to go there when you've got the right wind. And so that's one thing. Another thing that, of course, a lot of us, we've all learned a lot about scent control in the last 15 years with the advent of the scent-reducing clothes and the scent sprays and all of that stuff and the deodorants, scent-free deodorants and scent-free soap. And, I mean, there's tons of stuff out there now that wasn't available. We didn't have that stuff 30 years ago. None of that. And so I am way more scent conscious than I was 20 years ago.
Yeah, they're kind of a walking nose, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got a chapter in that Wildlife Advantage, Whitetail Advantage book on how deer smell. And I won't go through it now, but if you read that chapter on how deer smell and learn and pattern you based on them, what they smell, those old bucks have it all figured out, and it's tied to their nose. And so anything that you can do for scent control, including, for example, on warmer mornings when a hike to a tree stand is going to get you sweaty, just carrying your clothes till you get 100 yards from the stand and then putting them on before you get in and that kind of thing, those kinds of things are really important. So scent control is it's as important as anything.
Yeah, I was watching a commercial on the Outdoor Channel last night, and I got a little bit frustrated. My wife said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Well, this guy is," and I won't name the scent product they were using, the scent elimination product, but he was in the shower washing with this, you know, antimicrobial, which is great, which he needs to be doing, but he's bathing with his hands. And she said, "What are you so upset?" I said, "He's using his hands to wash." She goes, "Well, I thought you said it was an antimicrobial soap." I said, "It is, but it's the exfoliated skin cells that he's not really getting off of there very well, and that's what's going to be floating on those air currents." I said, if they're going to be showing this commercial with scent control products, at least have the guy, you know, washing with, you know, an abrasive glove or a washcloth or something. And I don't know how that would strike you, but, I mean, is that really what is alerting these deer to us being a predator for a big part of it is those exfoliated skin cells?
I don't know about that, but it's us. I mean, there's something about our scent. I mean, there's no question about the scent thing. And so anything that's going to put your scent out there is a potential problem, whether it's skin cells or your breath or, you know, one particular thing I think hunters need to think about is the fact that a lot of scent goes right up through the top of their head. And yeah. So the top of your head's extremely important to keep scent free, or your head and your hair. So all of those things are important, and I'm not sure you can do too much to prevent scent. And a couple of the really great deer hunters who you don't read about in the magazines, the good old boys who don't write stories and don't go on TV but kill monster bucks every year, those guys are scent-free freaks. They go to any extent to prevent their scent getting out.
I was talking with Eddie Claypool yesterday, and Eddie was, you know, he writes for Peterson's Bow Hunting Magazine. He's got over 3 dozen Pope and Young animals. Most of those all, you know, are all fair chase. Most of those on public land. And he says the one thing that guys just really don't pay attention to, like you just said it, Dave, is wind. You've got to know exactly what direction your winds are coming from. And you know, again, Charlie Alzheimer was going on about, he takes a little bubble canister up in the tree stand with him and blows bubbles and just watches where it's going.
Well, there's a, yeah, that will work. Except that I would worry about the smell.
The smell of the soap. I know. I was thinking that.
I don't know. But, you know, one other thing we haven't talked about, but I just want to sneak it in here, and that's calling deer, which is another thing that I've learned over the last 25 years. And there's so much now we know about how to call deer and what to do and how to rattle and that kind of stuff. But this snort-wheeze call, that Barry Wentzel taught me this, and was the first person to even talk about it in the literature, in the magazines. Barry and Gene Wentzel, the first people that I know of that talked about the snort wheeze call, which is the most aggressive call that deer give. And it definitely works, and you can do it with your mouth. You can buy a call, but you can do it with your mouth too, and just blowing through your teeth and make this wheeze sound. And I use it all the time. Sometimes I use it blindly, you know, just where you're sitting there in the morning and you don't hear anything at all. If you're rattling or even if you're not, give that snort wheeze call once in a while. Because if a dominant buck is anywhere nearby and hears that, and he's by himself, a lot of times he'll come and check it out. He thinks he's a dominant buck in that area. And when he hears a buck giving an aggressive call, that's almost always given right before they fight. So, I mean, it is definitely an aggressive call. And when he hears that, if he's a dominant guy, and he's been whipping up on everybody, and he hears that call, he's going to go in and check it out because somebody's challenged him. That's really a challenge. And that call works. When you see a buck, it's not going to come where you are. He's walking the other way or he's out of range. Give that call. I mean, I give a call. You have nothing to lose. You will not scare him. If you do scare him, it's a smaller buck. So if you're after big bucks, use that snort wheeze call.
I was the King Ranch down in Texas. Was it I think it was 70% of the they know of these whitetail bucks respond to these rattling sequences. But I think the research said, I may be wrong, you can correct me, is only see about 30% of those.
That's exactly right. When you rattle, that's exactly what that data showed. And I have that in my Whitetail Advantage book, by the way. When you rattle, and you're sitting on the ground, if you rattle from the ground or even in a tree, you only see approximately a third of the bucks that respond to the rattling, which means that there are bucks out there that are circling you the sound, and you don't see them. And then they get your wind once they circle you, and then they're gone. So, and that's why, Brent, it's so handy to have two people doing that, because you put the rattler 50 yards behind you or more, and he's rattling. So when that deer comes into the rattle and starts circling you, he'll walk right into you, the shooter, because the rattler's located behind you.
Boy, I had a really neat thing happen a couple of years ago over in southeastern Ohio. I had a young buck come in, a little 5-point. I had done a little, rattling sequence and a little snort wheeze and got a little stuff going, and this little 5-point came in right to the base of my tree. You know, he did this for like 3 mornings, and I was in a different stand, but it was, you know, in the morning I was up on top of the hill because of the thermals, and I was down low in the evening. But he came in to these different stands, the same buck, and I thought, man, this little guy's a fighter. He's just really trying to find out what's going on. Well, this one particular, it was actually morning, I did it. He came in, and I saw him just standing at the bottom of my tree, just kind of watching him for a minute, just watching his posture and seeing what, you know, he would had responded to. And I heard something behind me in the woods snap, and I knew there was no other hunter down there. And I couldn't turn around yet, but I watched the body language of that young buck underneath me. He tucked his tail underneath his legs, crouched down on the ground, and I mean almost like halfway down, and crawled into this thicket. And I turned around, and I knew there had to be something good coming. And it was a beautiful Pope and Young, 8-point. He was about probably 260-pound deer, big deer. And that deer came walking up just proud, stiff-legged. You could see the hairs on his back standing up. And when that deer left, he turned to go away. And I pulled out my snort wheeze again, and I just let her rip. And he turned sideways, and boy, that was all it took. He was ready to fight. He took about 2 steps, got into a perfect shooting lane at about 32 yards, and I ended up harvesting the deer, beautiful deer. But that snort wheeze call, I mean, he had turned his back to me. He was leaving. And I really believe that was one of the reasons why he spun back around. It was perfect timing in the rut. He thought he was the dominant buck, and he wasn't going to tolerate anybody else being in his area.
Well, that big buck I got in Iowa last year, I snort wheezed him in. I rattled, and he came in on my right side, and I was in a ladder, and I can't shoot on my right side because of my my bad surgery in my rib cage. The pain is so bad I can't stand. I'm lightheaded and I fall down when I stand up, so I have to sit to shoot my bow. So I couldn't stand up and turn my body. I just had to sit there. And so he went past me on my right side, and this is a 153 class whitetail, a big 6x6. And he went past me about 50 yards and then tried to circle around me to get my wind, and I shot him. I snort wheezed him in to about 25 yards, and then I ended up shooting him. And that snort wheeze that was too much for that deer. Man, he couldn't stand that. I gave that snort wheeze call, and he came straight in. I loved it.
No, I've seen guys take, I haven't done this because I've bought the calls that were designed with a hole in them to make a snort wheeze, but I've even heard you can take it as long as you don't puncture the reed. You can drill a little hole, tap into your call so that you can make that little sound, you know, to be able to do your snort wheeze. And I don't know if you've ever tried that or not.
I don't use a call. I just use my mouth.
You just use your mouth?
Yeah, you just, you put your upper teeth on your lower lip and on the inside of your lower lip and just blow out three quick blows and then one long wheeze call. That's what I do. I've never used a call. I just do it with your mouth. And it's handy to do it that way because you don't have to fool around with a call. You got your bow in your hand and you can just blast away. So,
I had a Boone and Crockett one time kick another 8-point off a hilltop I was on, and I never got a shot at him. But he let that snort wheeze out, and I'm telling you, it just makes the hairs on your arm stand up.
Oh, don't you love it? I love it.
I'm ready to go.
Yeah, me too.
Well, buddy, when you think about the last, you know, again, 10 years, something that you could look back at lessons that you've learned, maybe one of the most important things that you can think of in the last 10 years that's changed the way you hunt or the way that you look at things, what would it be?
Well, oh, that's a tough one, partner. I have to think about that. But one quick thing comes to my mind, and Bill Winke will talk about that if you interview Bill. And that is getting in and getting to your stand and your entrance and exit routes. Those are so critical. These deer know exactly what's going on. You know, remember the old days when people would build these tree stands, these big wooden clunker things that they'd hammer nails in trees before we had really good stands? Mm-hmm. And one thing I learned from Barry and Gene Wenzel and Roger Roth or some of the old-time guys, they knew that, but I didn't know that. You build the stand and pound around in the woods, and those big bucks know it's there before you hit your car. They live there. They know all of that stuff. And so if you park your car within 500 yards of where you're going to climb in your stand, and it's a place where cars are not normally going to and from that place, and you get out in the morning, those bucks, They know you're there. So if you're going to go into your stand, you need to park where they're used to hearing cars park. You park at the barn where the tractor runs and the kids come home from school. And I mean, you park right where the house is. But if you drive out into the field somewhere where cars don't normally park and you do that in the morning, those deer learn that in a heartbeat. And so entry and exit and taking great pains, that's important. And of course, as I already mentioned, scent and watching when you hunt from that stand is critical.
I think about these guys driving, you know, hours to get to a place where they're going to be hunting, and they put all this time and money and effort into that, but yet they don't want to make an entry and exit location that's inconvenient for them. And it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You're going to go that much time and it takes you an extra 10 minutes to get there. But it just doesn't make sense to me how it's really worth it.
You got to do it.
Yeah.
Just that simple. Hey, you can kill little bucks, and that's fine. You know, and I don't belittle anybody who shoots any legal buck at all. But if you want to kill big bucks, then you got to do these extra things.
That's what, you know, Wade Nolan, that's something he said the other day. He said, you know, it's the same thing. I don't belittle people. He said, because any, whether it's a doe or whether it's a small buck or whatever, any of those taken with a primitive weapon like a bow is a real trophy.
It's whatever you want it to be. And, you know, at age 70 now, you know, I'll shoot does for food, but I won't shoot a small buck just because I don't want to.
Yeah.
But if I got a 10-year-old or 11-year-old or 12-year-old hunting with me, I want him to shoot that buck.
Yeah.
Because when those young kids put a deer on the ground, and this the data shows this is true, when kids are under the age of 16 and they don't shoot a deer, they are much more liable to drop out of the out of hunting than those who kill a deer or a pheasant or a turkey. You want those kids to make a harvest. And it bothers me when fathers don't let their kids shoot does. If you got a young kid who's not killed deer, man, you want him to put something brown on the ground so that he'll stay in hunting longer.
My first deer was a doe, and I'm still to this day as proud of that deer as any deer I've taken.
Yeah, we need to instill that in kids, and the fathers need to. I know they're into this trophy stuff, but when it comes to your kids, let them have fun and let them do some shooting. And also, when the opportunity comes to harvest a doe, man, believe me, the father might not understand it, but those kids are going to be happy as clams when they kill that first doe.
Before we kind of finish up this thing, I want to thank you for being a part of this and the knowledge you have and the wisdom from all these years and everything you've been a part of. I know we have all been able to get a lot of knowledge and wisdom from your expertise from this. But I want to ask you a couple of questions. First of all, if someone wanted to be able to reach you for an event, find out more about you, where would they go?
Just go to my website, knowhunting.com, K-N-O-W. Just go to knowhunting, K-N-O-W.com, and I'm there.
As opposed to no hunting posted here.
Yeah, and that's right. And if you forget that, just Google my name, Dave Samuel, and my website will pop up. But that's how you get a hold of me, and it gives an email address and a phone number as well.
And you've got a new book that's coming out.
Hey, well, it's out. I'm looking at it right now. It's called Whitetail Racks. Put out by Krauss Publications. It's a coffee table type book, but it's got about 70,000 words in there on anything you want to know about antlers, and a lot of stuff that's never been published. Neat information, and it's getting great reviews, and actually it's doing really, really well. I'm really fired up about it. It's a dandy book.
Something that the listener won't know, because this was you and I were talking before we did the interview, but I want to go back to something because it just, I think it's really important, and we know from you know, your credentials and everything you've done, you're an expert. You're one of the top experts in your field, no question about it. But we don't maybe know you so much about a person, but I think that began to come through as you and I were talking earlier before it was on the interview. And I know that you have a personal relationship, you know, with the creator of the universe, and the way that you and I were just talking about how things have kind of changed, the way you even see things differently. What, you know, with who is Dave now? What, why do you do what you do?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but there's no question things changed in December of 2007 when I woke up in an intensive care unit and spent a lot of time there from a same day procedure that just went bad. I wrestled with that, you know, why me? You know, I've been a good guy, Lord. Why me? Why has this happened at a time when I'm looking forward to doing some hunts that I couldn't afford when I was younger and was hoping to do them, and now we'll never be able to do those things. Why me? And it took me about 4 months, and I read all kinds of books and listen to all kinds of people, but finally one day it just struck me that I'm not in charge. I don't know why me, but I do know this much though, Brent, and I tell people when I do my game dinners in churches, if you haven't had a bad thing happen to you or somebody in your family, then you just haven't lived long enough. And you can be a great and wonderful Christian person, and bad things will happen. Bad things happen to everybody. They just do. And, you know, and I'm not sure why. All I know is I'm not in charge. I didn't write the plan. I didn't write the book. I just believe it. And I believe the plan. And So you can either just roll up and crawl in your bed and peek out every once in a while to see if the world's still out there, or you can just get up and go do whatever you can do. And I chose the latter. Now, some days I'm weak in that regard because it's hard. But most days I'm pretty strong in that regard because it's life. And I know this much, Brent. If it wasn't for my relationship with God and believing in the Bible and what it teaches me every day, if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't make it through this.
Yeah.
There'd be no way. But here I am. And one other thing, hunting is a small community of people, but I'll tell you what, they have come out of the woodwork for me since I've been hurt. They're there every day.
I think God made us to be in community with one another. I really do.
And me too.
You know, I'm reminded as you're saying that, is that the man who was crippled, and Jesus said to him, "Do you want to be well?" And he's like, "Of course, yes." Then take up your mat and walk. And I don't even think that means that you have to be getting up. Maybe someone's crippled, it's maybe even hearing this. They can't necessarily get up and go and do the things that they used to be able to do. You've talked about wanting to be able to do hunts that you can't do now. But what I see you doing is you're getting up, you're taking up your mat and walking. You're going to do whatever it is that you're able to do. You're going to keep pressing on. And I think that is so important for all of us, no matter what our situation is with the economy. Maybe we've lost our job, our house, our marriage, our health, whatever that thing is. And again, I don't mean this to go into a sermon, but I trust the maker of the universe, the one who made this white-tailed deer that we love to pursue, mountaintops, great white sharks, grizzly bears, has an amazing imagination. And he made you and me, and he's put us here to be able to be loved on by him, and to be able to love others as he loved us. And Dave, your time, your patience, and either others even who have been praying for you, I'm reminded of that lesson that says if we want to find our life, we give it away. That's one of the things that keeps me getting up every day, because I know that if I start getting selfish about my life, I'm just might as well hang it up. But when I want to pour my life into others like you're doing with getting out to these events, you talked to me about being a part of the Rotary Club earlier and being a part of Gideon's. You're taking up your mat. You're not just walking, you're running. You're finishing the race well. And it's an inspiration. And I want to thank you for not only the no hunting lessons, but the life lessons that you've been giving us today, because I think that's even more important than all of this.
I appreciate that.
Well, buddy, thank you for your time. And keep hunting for truth. And I hope to see you in the woods soon.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.